This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, more than half the states divert money that was expected to help troubled homeowners. A death march in mostly black Benton Harbor, Michigan. And it cost a lot of money to be poor in America.
But first, progressives are jubilant about a federal judge's decision to allow a suit to go forward against the preventive detention bill signed into law by President Obama. Former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges was one of the plaintiffs. He said the law put him and every American in danger.
It is a piece of legislation that was essentially supported by our two political parties, by both parties. And indeed, the sponsors of the bill are Carl Levin, a Democrat, and John McCain, a Republican. There was no outcry within the systems of power itself, and that, of course, meant that there was no outcry within the media, which allows those systems of power to set the parameters of all debate. And that's why. It is an extremely frightening piece of legislation because of the sort of vagueness of the language itself. What does substantially supported mean? I mean, what does supported mean? What does substantially mean? What is the end of hostilities? You can seize American citizens who are accused of covered persons, is the term, of either substantially supporting Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or what they call associated forces. Again, a term that is not defined. And I think one of the most telling moments in the trial was at the end of the day when Judge Forrest asked the government attorneys directly, more than once, several times, would this legislation permit the government to detain any of these plaintiffs? And in question after question after question, the assistant attorney, Ben Torrance, refused to offer those kinds of guarantees.
He couldn't answer the question.
Right.
And did the judge ask him to say, can you define specifically what an associated force is of Al-Qaeda?
Precisely. And they would not define those terms because they can't. Those terms are expandable. And I think when you referred to the president's signing statement, which he issued, it's very important to realize that that has no legal standing. And in the signing statement, the promise is that his administration would not use it. But there is nothing in that signing statement to prohibit the government from using it, and certainly, most importantly, for future administrations, from using that mechanism to carry out, in essence, acts of extraordinary rendition on American soil against American citizens. And as somebody, I spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent, and when we went through the terrorism list, there were 17 groups on that list, including Al-Qaeda, that I have had, as a reporter, direct contact with. And there is no provision in there to protect journalists at all, or anyone. Anybody can be swept up under this. And you don't want to hand these kinds of powers to the state, because history has shown eventually they will use it. And I think finally it's important to understand what we are already seeing, which is an attempt to take Occupy and U.S. Day of Rage and other groups. And this was when they released the WikiLeaks 5 million emails of Stratfor, the private security company. We saw in those emails an attempt to link U.S. Day of Rage directly to jihadist groups and Al-Qaeda. That's the route you're going to go. When you create a surveillance state of this size and this magnitude, and I covered East Germany. I lived in East Germany, the Stasi state. They have to perpetuate themselves, and they do it through inanities and absurdities and false narratives and careerism. And I think that those of us who brought this lawsuit understand, finally, that this is not about the other. It's not about them. It's about us.
That was Chris Hedges speaking on Russia Today.
Following the judge's ruling, some of the plaintiffs and their lawyers held a press conference. Daniel Ellsberg, who revealed the existence of the Pentagon Papers more than four decades ago, said the preventive detention law had a dramatic effect on his own life and work.
For the last couple of years now, I've been a very active and enthusiastic supporter of WikiLeaks and of Bradley Manning. And both of those have been called WikiLeaks. It was called by the chairman of the House Homeland Security, Peter King, a terrorist organization, and said that he wanted to try to get it designated as such, but he called it that. Both Manning and Assange have been called terrorists by high-level officials and congresspersons of both parties, I think. and said they should be treated like Osama bin Laden and so forth. Now, I'm supporting then somebody who is identified by the people who are devotees of Homeland Security as it has been administered, people that they regard as terrorist groups, which is absurd. But I can't trust that that absurdity will prevent them from attaching that to me. If that has actually affected my willingness to email and phone various people associated with Assange and Bradley Manning that I would have done otherwise, on the grounds that just seeing them privately, talking to them privately, could very well, which I regard as supporting totally legal, constitutional, valuable activity, speech activity, could expose me to government interpretations that I am doing otherwise, that I'm supporting an associated activity, that I'm providing substantial support. I, like the others, don't know whether my discussions and my fundraising for them and supporting their views in many cases, along with some criticism of it, but definitely supporting, are what they mean by substantial support and indirect support or support the people who are associated with terrorists. So that means that whereas I certainly do not feel I've been trimming my sails in public here on that subject, it has already affected my free speech activities, which I don't want to expose me to being put in a black hole, a military detention in this country elsewhere, where I wouldn't be able to speak the way I did during my trial, and I'd be incommunicado, in effect, like Bradley Manning himself.
Daniel Ellsberg, one of the plaintiffs in the suit against preventive detention without trial.
The New York City Civil Liberties Union released a new study on the city's stop-and-frisk practice. Almost 700,000 people, mostly black and Latino males, were stopped by police last year. Candace Tolliver is Civil Liberties Union's lead organizer in its advocacy department. She says stop and frisk is disproportionately applied by race throughout the city.
Absolutely. Regardless of whether the district or the precinct was heavily populated with people of color, we still accounted for the majority of the stops, overwhelmingly. It basically shows you that it's not just about cops saying we go where the crime is, right, in those neighborhoods being neighborhoods that are primarily of color, but it's about wherever people of color are, they're going to be stopped and frisked by police.
We see differences in police behavior based on the difference in precincts, however. In the 46th precinct of the Bronx, you found that more than 80% of the time, people are frisked when they are stopped. Stop and frisk doesn't mean people are always frisked, but less than 30% of the time in a precinct on the east side of Manhattan. This is a much whiter precinct. One would draw the conclusion that police tend not to frisk white people, or at least people they stop in whiter areas.
Yeah, and you know what is even more telling about that is that when they actually do recover guns, they're more likely to recover guns on white people than they are on people of color. So they're stopping and they're frisking a lot of blacks and Latinos, but they're not getting the same outcome when they actually frisk a white person. It's really telling.
One could deduce from that the police are stopping white people who actually are more suspicious.
We don't know for sure, right, because we don't have that information, but one would think that maybe they're actually using good policing when they're stopping white folk, but not necessarily, you know, using that same level of scrutiny for when they stop black and Latinos on the street.
That is, blacks and Latinos are stopped in a blanket fashion, whereas whites are stopped possibly with more reasonable cause.
Maybe that's what's happening. We don't really know what's happening. When we look at the reason for the stop, a lot of the reasons that they give when stopping folks is like furtive movement and things like that, which are very open and like we really don't know what they mean when they say that a lot of the times. But the bottom line is their hit rate is really low when it comes to guns in general, but it's even lower when it comes to retrieving guns from Black and Latino folk. Yet, we do know that more and more Black and Latino folks are being frisked and searched when they're stopped than white people that are stopped.
We see that only about 10% of the people who are stopped are charged with anything. 90% are not. But the people who actually did nothing wrong may be more than 90%, because some people are charged after they object to being stopped.
Absolutely. So a lot of times what's important to recognize is that when you account for what arrests are made, when you do have instances of arrest or summonses for stop and frisk, it's almost always low-level violations and misdemeanors. It's never really high-level crime. So a lot of times when people are stopped, the charges like disorderly conduct, and that could come from the situation getting heightened or a person getting upset while because they're being stopped maybe for the fifth, sixth, tenth time that year. So, you know, a lot of times that the situation can heighten, and those are the charges. The number one arrest last year was marijuana arrest, right? Which is also a low-level misdemeanor. So it's not that when they are finally making an arrest or handing out a summons, it's for something serious, right? It's normally low-level violations and misdemeanors that they're actually giving to people when they are stopped.
The department and the mayor continue to insist that no quotas are involved in stop and frisk, but the numbers keep going up, and even police say they're under pressure to make more stops and more frisks.
There have been different police officers that have come forward. The Village Voice did a piece last year about police officers coming forward about quotas. We don't have all the information on it, but when we see the numbers of stops going up and up and up, right, every year it's more and more people that are being harassed and humiliated on the streets. The bottom line is that the police department needs to find a better strategy of combating crime than stopping thousands of innocent New Yorkers every year.
The mayor doesn't seem to be backing off, but does there appear to be a crystallization of community opposition to stop and frisk developing?
Absolutely. Now is the time for some police accountability. You have movements springing up all over New York City calling for police reform. You have a new campaign called Communities United for Police Reform. Almost 30 organizations around New York City have come together to fight these discriminatory policing practices. There's been, you know, new legislation that's been introduced by Councilman Jermoni Williams and some more of the progressive leaders in the city council that are all calling for reform on discriminatory practices such as stop and frisk. You have, you know, the stop and frisk movement, and you have, you know, all types of different people all coming together right now just to say, you know, we're tired and we're fed up of this practice, and we need a change. There's actually on Father's Day going to be a march with put together by the National NAACP, the National Action Network, 1199, the Communities United for Police Reform, NYCLU is also organizing, where it's going to be hopefully thousands of people, you know, marching from Harlem to say we're upset about these abuses of our people and we want to change. So there's a groundswell happening where right now is the time for change, and right now people are pissed off about what's happening and what they see on the streets, and NYPD has to react.
That was Candace Tolliver of the New York City Civil Liberties Union.
The family of John Carter, a prisoner in solitary confinement in Pennsylvania, has filed a criminal complaint in his death. Carter died when guards entered his cell firing pepper spray canisters and electric shock weapons. Brett Gordy is with Pennsylvania's Human Rights Coalition.
John Carter spent the last 10 to 11 years of his life in solitary confinement in a little bathroom, solid concrete cell in at least four or five different Pennsylvania prisons. On April 26th of 2012, John Carter was killed while guards in riot gear armed with what the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections refers to as chemical munitions, otherwise known as pepper spray, and are also armed with electroshock weapons, stormed into his cell after dousing it with reportedly three canisters of pepper spray, shocked, according to witness statements we received, anywhere between 5 to 7 times, and we're not sure what exactly happened while the guards were in his cell, but his body was dragged from there minutes later lifeless, and he was pronounced dead later that night. Now, whenever there are deaths inside of Pennsylvania prisons that are not from, quote, natural causes, the Pennsylvania State Police are called in to do a pro forma so-called investigation as it is. The family members to date have not been convinced that there's actually any investigation going on, and they have no reason to believe that there is. Just last week, the Pennsylvania State Police stated they believe there was no foul play in the death of John Carter, yet the Human Rights Coalition, who I work with, continue to receive reports from prisoners indicating that not one witness has been spoken to by the Pennsylvania State Police, either regarding the cell extraction itself, the incidents leading up to it, or the rather steady stream of reports of physical and psychological abuse, racist actions on behalf of guards, issuance of fabricated misconducts to keep people buried in the hole who protest or who might file grievances or lawsuits about staff misconduct, etc. None of this is being looked into by the Pennsylvania State Police. So the family of John Carter, in particular his sister Michelle Williams and his cousin Clarissa Williams, have been working with us to seek to force this out of the obscurity which the Department of Corrections is counting on it to remain in. And as part of that, they have filed criminal complaints that have been submitted to the District Attorney of Center County, to the Pennsylvania State Police Headquarters and the barracks in State College, which is where this prison was located. And also they have forwarded these complaints on to the United States District Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, calling for a federal investigation, and forwarded it to the state of Pennsylvania's Attorney General's office to seek a transparent investigation, so that, but not just to seek an investigation, but to seek charges to be brought on this, because we have already received sufficient number of reports from people on the inside to know that, contrary to the state police's claim last week, there was certainly foul play involved, not just in the cell extraction, but in the 10 years of solitary confinement torture that John Carter experienced prior to April 26th.
Yes, that is the larger point. It seems the family intends not just to look into the immediate circumstances of his death on that day, but what they describe as torture in the weeks and months and years preceding it.
Yes, exactly. And without understanding the context of how Pennsylvania uses its control units, its solitary units, what they euphemistically refer to as restricted housing units or special management units or secure special needs units, none of the reports that are coming from the unit or this talk of his death really make any sense whatsoever. We've documented hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of human rights violations, many amounting to torture, in well over a dozen Pennsylvania prisons in the last 5 years. Basically, every prison that has a control unit has certain characteristics that go on in these units. One is that they're designed to kill. While most of the prisoners that enter into these units or enter into these prisons don't end up leaving like John Carter did in a body bag, these institutions are designed to inherently kill the spirit. They're designed to break people. They're designed to make them pliable so that they are not capable of exercising any agency or any self-determination, and that they are subject to the arbitrary dictates of the prison system. So those who file grievances, those who file lawsuits, those who stand up against abuse and against their own dehumanization and against that of their fellow prisoners are the ones who are most systematically and relentlessly and viciously targeted by the system. And John Carter was one of those individuals, and that is probably the primary reason that he spent a decade in solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement is a kind of social death. People estimate as many as 20,000 nationwide are confined to solitary lives. About how many in Pennsylvania?
The Department of Corrections figures put the number at approximately 2,500. I think that could be an undercount, because I know of certain units that don't appear to be counted in their official stats, but we'd say around 2,500, which is, I think that's approximately 2 to 4% of the prisoner population. It's relatively par for the course within the prison nation that we inhabit. But a point of clarification, that 20,000 figure I've seen as well seems to be referring to those who are held in supermax institutions proper, so institutions that are in their entirety devoted to solitary confinement, control unit-style lockdown. But I know Solitary Watch and some others have reported that a more accurate estimate for people who actually just held in control units in supermaxes or, like John Carter, in just the restricted housing unit within your standard medium or maximum security prison is closer to 80,000, if not more. This was written from an open letter to the family of slain comrade John Carter by another long-term solitary confinement survivor who is in the state correctional institution Rockview where Carter was killed. Quote, "The oppressor maimed and hurt J. Rock's body, but they can never, ever take his spirit from him or us. When you think of J. Rock, think of George and Jonathan Jackson, Martin and Malcolm, Sojourner and Miss Parks, and all of our other great warriors who walked their talk and transitioned with no regrets."
Brett Grote of the Human Rights Coalition speaking in Philadelphia.
The U.S. Justice Department has issued new guidelines on the treatment of the nation's prison population, including restrictions on housing juveniles with adults. The action comes on the heels of a department report on sexual abuse behind bars. It found sexual abuse to be pervasive, affecting one of 10 prisoners. Louisa Stanow is executive director of Just Detention International.
The report released today by the Department of Justice is a report where they speak to former prisoners. So they're able to talk to prisoners who are no longer detained and who, many of whom are speaking of a much longer period in detention. So previous studies by the Department of Justice have covered 1 year. This study covers a slightly longer period. And what they're finding in speaking with these former prisoners is that almost 1 in 10 reports having been sexually abused during his or her last period of detention. And these are very alarming high numbers.
And I suppose since they're former prisoners and don't plan to go back, they could speak more freely.
That's certainly the intent of this particular survey, and the Department of Justice actually interestingly spells that out in one of the introductory pages, that they have chosen to do this survey of former prisoners precisely because they're hoping to capture the experiences of people who are no longer living with the active, acute fear of retaliation if they speak the truth.
And the word retaliation figures prominently in the report, that about half of prisoners who try to report that they've been sexually abused are retaliated against by the staff of the prison.
Yes. The levels of retaliation that are shown in this report are stunning. We hear frequently from prisoner rape survivors who contact Just Detention International. They often say that they did not speak to anybody, and we always ask why. And one of the most common answers is that I didn't want to tell anybody because I was afraid of getting written up. I really wanted to go home. There was no way I would tell a corrections official because I would have gotten in trouble. This is anecdotal evidence that we have received over and over and over. And now, through today's report by the Department of Justice, we really see in the data that they're absolutely right. Prisoners have a reason to fear retaliation because they are so often retaliated against if they do file a report. It's interesting to see in today's study that while it's dangerous to report any form of sexual abuse in detention, you're especially likely to be retaliated against by staff if you report the abuse perpetrated by other staff.
One startling statistic that comes out of this report is that female prison staff were by far the most likely perpetrators, and that female inmates were more than 3 times as likely to be victimized by another prisoner than male inmates.
That's right. The Bureau of Justice Statistics report makes it very clear that efforts to stop sexual abuse in detention have to address all forms of sexual abuse, regardless of the gender of the victim or the gender of the perpetrator. Any corrections official with unchecked powers who does not receive sufficient training, when there is not enough oversight, there will be a risk for sexual abuse in a setting where an official has those extreme powers and literally holds the key to the other person's freedom. And what we see in today's report is that women corrections officials also are very likely to perpetrate sexual abuse against inmates in their custody. And the rates of sexual abuse by female perpetrators in today's Department of Justice report really highlights the need for us all to start talking much more openly about sexual abuse perpetrated by women against men in detention. It's a kind of abuse that often has been minimized. We have heard many times of women who have been found to have engaged in custodial sexual misconduct in the sexual abuse of male inmates, and rather than being prosecuted or held accountable, they have been allowed simply to leave their jobs.
That was Lavisa Stanow of Just Detention International.
When 49 state attorneys general and the nation's biggest banks agreed to a settlement of the bank's abusive foreclosure practices, homeowners expected that $25 billion in relief money was on the way. But more than half the states plan to use their share of the money for other purposes. Arizona wants to spend a lot of it on prisons. Tim Hogan of the Arizona Center for Law in the Public Interest says his group plans to sue.
It's an awful idea, and I think it's unlawful, at least under the terms of the settlement, insofar as it applies to Arizona. You know, each state has different provisions as part of this consent judgment. Now, your point's well taken. I mean, I think it's understood that the money generally in all the 49 states that participated should be going to support housing services and assisting homeowners in foreclosure and providing supplemental payments and legal assistance and things like that. But each state, it's one thing to say that it was understood, but each state crafted separate provisions for how the money was going to be treated. And in Arizona, the provision establishes a court-ordered trust fund that the attorney general here administers for the benefit of these homeowners who were harmed by these mortgage practices. And so we're going to claim that as trustee of this fund, it would be a dereliction of his duty to just accede to the legislature's demand that he take half of that money and put it into the state's general fund, which funds everything, including prisons. So it's basically just deficit relief here in Arizona, although we're operating at a surplus this year. So
a layman might conclude that state of Arizona thinks that prison is a housing program.
That's for sure. They might consider it a housing program and an education program, you know, all things together and all things to all people. You know, we have more prisoners per capita, I think, than just about any other state in the United States.
We may also be getting an education about what the negotiations revolving around the settlement with the banks were really about. Some of the states apparently didn't think that the issue was housing at all, but revenue.
Apparently, that's right. I mean, some of the states, the last count I looked, maybe it's 29 states out of the 49 were just going to take this money and put it into their general fund. But, I mean, I don't know what the point of going through this exercise and all of these lawsuits to create this fund of money is if the money's not going to be used to help these people out.
It certainly did create a great expectation among some folks that relief was on the way.
It did. We've had a hard enough time with these programs reaching the people who really need the help, and this just looks like another disappointment in a series of disappointments for people who are in distressed circumstances and just desperately need some help to get themselves out of it.
How close are you to taking legal action?
I'm hoping we're able to get it done next week.
And in your experience, what are the chances for getting relief?
Well, that's a good question. We think we have an excellent claim under Arizona's constitution that the legislation enacted here requiring the attorney general to transfer these funds is unconstitutional. But that doesn't solve our problem entirely, because I think the Attorney General will voluntarily transfer these funds, regardless of the requirement coming from the legislature. And he'll do that because I think the legislature has probably told him that if he doesn't transfer the funds, they're just going to take it out of his general budget. And so that's where our claim that he would be violating his duties as a trustee here come into play. If he were to just take this money and dump it into the general fund and not use it to assist these people, he's not acting appropriately as a trustee.
One is tempted to ask if this is yet another blight on Arizona, but it looks like Arizona has plenty of company.
Yeah, Arizona's not alone here, that's for sure.
Tim Hogan of the Arizona Center for Law in the Public Interest.
In New York, we spoke with Alan Jenkins of Opportunity Agenda. He says diversion of the housing settlement money will disproportionately harm blacks.
Despite the progress we've seen in America on equal opportunity, we have also seen that racial discrimination and unequal opportunity has played a part at every stage of the homeownership and foreclosure crisis. So African-American homeowners were targeted for subprime and often predatory loans and more likely to be offered those loans even when they were middle class or upper middle class. We've seen that segregation in communities has exacerbated the effect of foreclosures, and so you've got large communities being displaced. And even now that we seem to be headed in a more positive direction, you see, for instance, that banks are less likely to maintain foreclosed properties that they own in communities of color than they are homes in white communities. They're less likely to keep them up and maintain them and to try to resell them and the like. So unfortunately, unequal treatment has been a part of this crisis all along. Now we see that after an historic settlement by state attorneys general and the Obama administration against banks that practiced fraud and misconduct, states are taking those settlement funds, many states, and putting them into their general coffers instead of devoting them to helping people who are struggling with foreclosures, who are the victims of these kinds of fraudulent practices by the banks. In a state like Wisconsin, for example, or Georgia, where those deceptive practices by banks were targeted in cities like Atlanta and Milwaukee, many people of color, African Americans, were targeted and are suffering from foreclosures. If that settlement money then goes into the general funds of the state, those people who were victimized are not going to benefit in any way that's consistent with the way in which they were victimized.
In fact, the state of Arizona is planning to use a substantial part of those monies for prisons.
Right. And in many ways, that's adding insult to injury. Here is a settlement that was intended to address a specific harm, an insult to the American dream and a violation of our belief in equal opportunity for all. And those funds should be directed specifically towards remedying that problem.
Well, people expected that that was the intent, but 29 of the states are taking the money and running with it.
Well, some positive things are going to come out of this settlement. For instance, reducing the amounts that some of these homeowners owe on their mortgages to fair levels that they can repay and keep their homes. But at the same time, the diversion of a lot of this money by a large number of states is really going to make a bad problem worse.
Well, there have been diversions and diversions by omission. $6.7 billion of TARP funds was supposed to be allocated to a hardest hit fund, that is, homeowners and areas and classes of people that were hardest hit by the housing crisis, but only 3% of it got spent by the U.S. Treasury Department.
Well, we've seen that there have been some positive solutions implemented by the administration and Congress and by states around the country, but there are other significant missed opportunities. So what you mentioned is certainly one of those. We've also seen that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which hold a large number of mortgages of Americans who are underwater, meaning that their home is worth less than they owe, Fannie and Freddie should be reducing the principal on those mortgages to amounts that people can repay and successfully claim their homes. That's good for neighborhoods. It's good for our national economy. It's a missed opportunity that that is not happening.
And it should be an election issue as well.
Well, I hope that it will be an election issue. We should all be asking both of the presidential candidates, as well as people running for Congress, city council, governor, dog catcher, what their plan is for restoring the American dream and the promise of home opportunity.
That was Alan Jenkins of Opportunity Agenda in New York.
On Capitol Hill in Washington, a bill's been introduced to make it easier to register to vote. The measure includes proposals developed by the Brennan Center for Justice that would modernize the voting process. Nicole Austin Hillary thinks the bill stands a good chance of passage.
Even though right now the House is majority Republican and this is a Democratic-led effort, the voting rights community, and particularly the Brennan Center, are very excited about the introduction of this bill because we believe very strongly that protecting voting rights is not a partisan issue. It is really an issue that is core to our democracy. Everyone should have the right to vote. Everyone should have the right to vote, and that should be unencumbered. And it really doesn't matter what leaders are trying to ensure that the right to vote is protected. So we are extremely hopeful that members of both caucuses will become supporters of this legislation.
The Republicans are constantly talking about voter cheating, voter fraud, which we know very rarely happens, statistically speaking. Your bill would prevent voter disenfranchisement, which we know happens a whole lot. Tell us about voter caging.
Voter caging is an issue that really deals with efforts to remove registered voters solely on the basis of the fact that their mail is undeliverable to them. And the voter registration modernization effort that is part and parcel, really is the core provision of this bill, would ensure that that would no longer be possible. It would prevent voter disenfranchisement as a result of voter caging, because under voter registration modernization, an individual would become registered to vote, and that would be permanent registration as long as they live in that particular state. Whether they move to a new address, that information would be updated. Their registration would follow them wherever they go in that state. So this whole issue of not being able to deliver mail to them would become moot.
And we know that basing registration on mail deliverability has racial implications and implications for poor people, because poor people move a lot more and have far less security in getting their mail.
Absolutely. That's why we think that voter caging is something that absolutely had to be a significant part of any voter registration reform, because we want to ensure that all people, regardless of economic class, educational status, race, gender, any label that you can put on people, we did not want that to be something that inhibited people from accessing the ballot box, because we know that historically in this country, the groups of people who have been disenfranchised have been the poor, have been the minority. So we wanted to make sure that we were targeting those very groups who need that kind of protection.
This Voter Empowerment Act tries to end deceptive practices that are designed to confuse voters on election day itself. Deceptive practices, that sounds like every trick in the book. What do you mean?
Deceptive practices deal with activities that have the result of confusing voters by giving them misinformation. One of the probably most notable deceptive practices occurrences happened in the state of Maryland over the last few years during the gubernatorial race, wherein individuals who were working on behalf of the Republican candidate were contacting voters in a predominantly African-American county on Election Day and were leaving messages on home answering systems that were telling these voters, if you were going to come out and vote for the Democratic candidate, don't worry, stay home, your guy has already won. That is a prime example of a deceptive practice, wherein some activity is taking place solely to misinform a voter, and that misinformation would then have the result of somehow impacting that voter's ability to go out or their desire to go out, because they are basing their decision not to go out and vote on this deceptive misinformation.
And could someone go to jail as a consequence of these deceptions?
Someone absolutely could. In fact, with respect to the example that I just gave you in the state of Maryland, there actually has been a trial of some of the individuals who were charged with violating a deceptive practices law in the state of Maryland. There certainly are criminal penalties, which can include jail time.
Under this bill, people with past criminal convictions would be, their right to vote in federal elections would be restored. How many people are we talking about?
We are talking about up to 4 million Americans, and that particular provision of the Voter Empowerment Act is also the result of a Brennan Center policy proposal that dealt with felony enfranchisement. This would ensure that individuals who have already paid their debt to society would have that right to vote restored. We feel very strongly, and we know that this country is really a country that's based on giving people other opportunities, second chances, once they've paid their debt to society. This provision of the bill would ensure that once an individual has completed their incarceration period, they can resume their voting rights, their voting practices with respect to federal elections. And we know that is so important to communities. It's important to families. When individuals have finished their incarceration periods, we ask them to become full citizens. We ask them to get a job, to take care of their homes, their families, to pay taxes. And we certainly think that being able to exercise your right to vote is part and parcel of resuming one's full citizenship.
Finally, the bill requires paper ballots and post-election audits.
The Brennan Center actually works a great deal on issues dealing with voting machines and the accuracy of voting machines. This bill, and we certainly support this, would require that paper ballots be used and that these audits be done to ensure the accuracy of the election results. We think of these as safeguards to make certain that some of the problems that we've seen in this country in the past, most notably in the 2000 election, don't reoccur. We think that this particular provision gives the voting public confidence that, one, their vote is counted, and that, two, it's counted correctly, and that the outcome of the elections are in line with exactly the way voters have cast their ballots.
Nicole Austin Hillary of the Brennan Center for Justice.
National People's Action and the National Domestic Workers Alliance led hundreds of demonstrations in Washington this weekend in a variety of protests against greedy bankers. We ask Mary Marino of National People's Action if she's surprised at people's willingness to confront corporate America.
I think it's been a long time coming. I think for a long time our anger and disgust has been focused on governments, but now it's become really clear. I think Citizens United helped really push this to the forefront that government is not the problem. Government is the prize. And the problem is that right now, that prize sits on a Wall Street trophy case.
The wing of the movement that you're involved in is putting pressure on Bank of America and Wells Fargo and the people that actually hold the majority of assets of the United States.
Exactly. And these are people who were responsible for really driving the economy into the ground and who, through their continued malpractices, are keeping us there. Right now, the economy as it is works for them, but it doesn't work for everybody else. And I think that's why we see such enthusiasm, because people see that corporate profits have skyrocketed. But their bottom lines haven't improved at all. If anything, they've gone steadily down. They see a rise in foreclosures. They see a rise in unemployment. And then they see all these people in Wall Street who keep getting these exorbitant bonuses. And they know something's not right with that.
Well, why should a banking institution and these fabulously billionaire rich folks on Wall Street, why should they have all the power that comes from having all that money?
They shouldn't. They didn't create it alone. They needed our help. They needed our labor. They needed our government. It's been very subsidized. It's been like a subsidized risk, but they get to keep all the profits. And that's what we're trying to change. That culture of the economy only working for them.
What kind of restrictions do you think should be put on the Banks of America and Wells Fargo's and the rest of those Wall Street brands?
Right now what we're really pushing for is Robin Hood tax, which would put a very small tax on Wall Street speculation. And this is when they buy and trade stocks really quickly just to make a profit. But it also helps to make the economy very unstable. It also helps drive up prices in things like gas and oil. It would be a small tax, but it would help generate a lot of revenue. And we also want the Bush tax credits to expire on the very rich.
That was Mary Marino of National People's Action.
Residents of the mostly black town of Benton Harbor, Michigan, charge that the giant Whirlpool Corporation is trying to depopulate the city. Reverend Ed Pinckney is bringing the protest to the local luxury golf course PGA tournament. He's organized what he calls a death march.
During the death march, what we're going to do, we're going to fill the coffin with residents' names that have been killed, murdered, or have left this community. At one time, we had over 30,000 people living inside the city of Benton Harbor less than 5 years ago. Today, we have less than 10,000 people inside the city of Benton Harbor. And what we're going to do, the death march will consist of, we're going to have a Benton Harbor resident on the coffin, and we're going to have our Whirlpool signs that Whirlpool commits genocide. And then we're going to have the casket, we're going to have the bagpipes, we're going to have one big bass drum, and we're going to take one step at a time with the coffin until we get through the golf course. I think it's going to be so dramatic. I'm so excited about it, and people are going to be coming from all over the country just for this, for Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday and Sunday.
Explain to us how Whirlpool Corporation is responsible for the depopulation of Benton Harbor.
The most important thing that they have done when they start outsourcing the jobs here. See, Whirlpool was one of the leading manufacturers, well, they are the leading manufacturer of the stove refrigerators, washer dryers, and the plants was mostly here where it kept people working until they started outsourcing the jobs to places where they can get cheaper labor. And what that have done, it has started eliminating people because jobs is hard to come by here. Period. So they were more responsible for that than anything else. And then what they did, they took over our city government. And when I use the term took over, I mean they was paying them underneath the table. Now, that was the beginning of my problem with the recall of one of the commissioners when they accused me of voter fraud. So it all stems from Whirlpool backing these individuals who they knew that they can get land from, or who they knew that they can get whatever they want from, and they continually to drive the residents from the city of Benton Harbor completely out of his city. No jobs, no nothing, no land, no houses, no nothing. They even tried to change the name from Benton Harbor to Harbor Shores, and even changed from Benton Harbor to Harbor Shores, St. Joseph, Michigan.
Because Benton Harbor is associated with its residents, black people.
Absolutely. We're about 94% now African American. We was 99, now we're 94. And the surrounding areas, they're 99, 94, 95% Caucasians.
It's not just that Benton Harbor is a black island in a white sea. You've got a very specific antagonist, a very rich multinational corporation.
A multi-billion-dollar corporation, and right now they have partnership with Mercedes-Benz, the PGA, the Harbor Shores Project. They always have this group called the Cornerstone Alliance, which is a subdivision of Whirlpool. They do all the work, all the dirty work, and that way Whirlpool don't get their hands dirty.
Looks like you're going to have fun, as you always do, while you fight the powers that be.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, I'm excited. We sent out a demand to the PGA requesting that they give the city of Benton Harbor a percentage of the gross take. And here's the reason why. They came here, they disrupted the whole city. Residents cannot even get to their own homes unless they have a pass to get through. Then they allow Harbor Shores to pump water freely out of the Pawpaw River. So it's things that's happening around here that people need to know, because if it's happening here in Benton Harbor, it could happen to your city next.
Reverend Ed Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
It costs a whole lot of money to be poor in America. That's the thrust of a recent article by Gary Rivlin titled America's Poverty Tax. Rivlin says it costs about $2,500 a year for the working poor to be poor.
I started looking at how much the average customer has to pay because they've messed up their credit and don't have a credit card, or they have a very expensive subprime credit card. What about the people who have bounced too many checks, gotten too deep in a hole with their bank, messed up the relationship with the bank, how much are they paying for check cashing charges, etc. So I try to look at all the different ways. You know, the extra price of auto insurance if you live in a low-income neighborhood because there's more cars stolen there. And I just, you know, just it's almost like a business exercise. I just want to see how much these businesses charge. And, you know, it comes out that the payday lender, you know, those who make these short-term cash loans, two-week loans, at preposterously high interest rates, you know, 400% or more, they collect about $600-$700 per customer. And they've got like 10-14 million customers a year. You look at rent to own. It's, you know, you don't have the money to buy the kids a bedroom set. You can't put it on a credit card. So you buy it on time through rent to own. You end up paying 2.5 as much. The average customer spends $1,200 at a rent to own shop. So that's like a $700 overage fee. So I just kind of went the check cashers. That's kind of the biggest bite. Depends on who you believe, but somewhere between 12 and 17, 20 million people don't have a checking account. And the average person, I found this study from Brookings, the average person, customer of a checking cash place is making $22,000 a year and spending $900 of it. I mean, right there, that's like 4 or 5%. Spending $900 of it on check cashing fees, an extra couple paying bills. You know, you don't have a check, you don't have checks, how are you paying the landlord, how are you paying the utility companies? And, you know, you add it up, you know, the pawnbroker, et cetera, you add it up, and it's a lot of money.
And yet, the check cashing business is part of what is called the financial services industry. That's a hell of a service.
Well, you know, I mean, in defense of the check cashers, if they weren't providing this service, how would people who don't have a checking account cash a check? There'd have to be somebody doing it. My problem isn't with check cashers per se. My problem isn't that they exist. It's that, you know, the caps on how much they could charge vary so widely from state to state. One-third of the states have no cap on what they can charge. And, you know, to cash a paycheck, a very reliable check, they're charging 5% of the worth of the check, 7%. A bunch of states have a cap at 5%. I'm in New York where the cap is great. It's 1.7%. And, you know, for $20,000 worth of payroll checks over the course of the year, that's $400. As opposed to if you lived in Georgia or Arkansas where the cap is 5%, you're paying $1,000.
In that sense, loan sharks and bookies also provide a service. If my memory serves me, I believe that Barack Obama, in his term in the Senate, one of his first votes was to vote against a cap on credit card charges.
Yes, the usury cap. As a presidential candidate in 2008, he came out in favor of a cap on interest rate charges, a cap of 36 percent, but it's gotten nowhere. And, you know, Dick Durbin, you know, the other senator from Illinois, very powerful Democrat, he's proposed legislation that would have a national usury cap of 36%. So the payday lenders couldn't charge fees that worked out to 400% a year. The pawnbrokers couldn't charge 250% interest on their loans. But it hasn't gotten anywhere, but it's a very powerful set of interest, you know, these fringe financiers. I mean, the payday lenders are a very big multi-million-dollar lobby there in Washington. You've got the big banks who have been funding. I mean, J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo, Bank of America, they've all provided funding to the payday lenders, the check cashers. So they have a stake in it, too. And, you know, they own the Republicans and they own a share of the Democratic Party. And so there's never much traction on a there's never any traction on a usury cap.
Yes, many people think of these cash checking services and others as storefront fly-by-night operations, but they're hooked into the big guys, the biggest guys.
I wrote this book, Broke USA, where I spent a couple years on the economic fringes, you know, investigating who are these businesses, who's been funding them, who's behind it. I thought the corner check cashier, I happen to live around the corner from two of them here in New York City, and I thought they would fly by night. It turns out that there's huge chains. There are six publicly traded companies that are in the check cashing business, or seven, if you include Walmart, which got into it, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. There are six publicly traded companies in the payday lending industry. Rent to own. I thought rent to own was the scruffiest little smallest business there was, but it's a $7 billion a year business. dominated by Rent-A-Center, which is a single company bringing in $3 billion a year plus. In revenues, it is more profitable than Best Buy or the retailers because, again, they get to charge charging two and a half times what buying the item, you know, you and me buying the item at a store would cost.
Gary Rifflin is author of the book Broke USA.
Dr. Gerald Horn, the noted professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, is a regular guest on Norman Richmond's Saturday morning show on Regent Radio in Toronto, Canada. Dr. Horn says the U.S. is growing increasingly isolated from the main direction of world affairs.
I think what's happening in the world right now is that the world is moving to the left. You see that with the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. You see this with the recent European elections. But the United States is not moving to the left. And there's the dilemma. Now, what's happened traditionally, and I should add that this tendency of the world moving to the left and the United States not doing so is nothing new. Indeed, historians such as myself have suggested that slavery was abolished in no small part because the international community led by the then reigning superpower, Great Britain, was moving to the left, which then impacted the United States to the point where it had to move in a similar direction and abolish slavery. You could say the same thing for Jim Crow, U.S.-style apartheid. You can say the same thing for U.S. support of South African apartheid in the 1970s and 1980s. And so that's the situation where we are now, which is one of the reasons why I think it's important to focus so heavily on these elections in Europe in particular, because the U.S. will have to move in the same direction, even though if you look at the U.S. elections, North Carolina, the gay marriage amendment, what happened in Indiana in particular, where the right-wing populist Tea Party forces prevailed, the United States is moving to the right. And in fact, there is a credible argument to be made that the courts dominated by the conservatives in the United States will rule that various kinds of unemployment compensation, Social Security, government pensions, and the like, not to mention this rather frail national health care system, are all illegal and all unconstitutional, which of course will be a disaster for poor working people. And one of the few hopes is that the international community will keep moving to the left, which will stay the hand of the United States.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Giselle Hernandez.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.